Well, thank you all. It was well done. Now we're going to invite the residents to come up in a panel type format. And if anyone has questions to address a specific topic that was done, please stand up to the microphone and address that that topic to that resident. We have about 15 minutes to do that or so.
So I have two questions. The first is for Dr. Ardema. I wondered if you could comment on billing for the e-health visits. They take the same amount of time, like you said, but if you can't do a physical exam, which would be required for, say, a level three, how does that affect the physician reimbursement? And then my other question was for Dr. Kernan, and I wondered if you could comment on cost as a barrier to the more effective forms of contraception for the teenagers.
So that's a great question, and it certainly that is a standard question throughout the whole e-visit realm. And quite frankly, this is one of the challenges that we've run into at Porter Family Medicine and initiated in our program is how is this supposed to be billed? What insurance companies will pay, those that won't? And unfortunately, I don't have a great answer for that. Now, in some of the research that I looked at, I showed those numbers between an in-office visit for a UTI versus an e-visit. And in part, the reason that visit was lower was because reimbursement to the physician was slightly lower. Now, they did take into consideration some other things with lab tests and whatnot, but at this stage, we still don't have a great answer to say, how are you going to bill? I know that a lot of the insurance companies have certainly put their pencil to paper and some have committed to pay for e-visits, some have not committed for e-visits. And quite frankly, in our pilot program at McKD, or at Porter Clinic, I should say, we have limited that specifically to IHC-insured patients because they are paying currently. So there's still certainly some growth that needs to take place in the reimbursement realm.
Another question for you.
Oh, I was just going to answer the cost barrier question that Dr. Poff brought up. So cost is absolutely a barrier to long-acting reversible methods. They are quite a bit more expensive than your Walmart Sprintec. So that is absolutely an issue, and unfortunately not all insurances are covering them. The biggest issue I've seen is our uninsured patients, and then the financial assistance patients have a major issue affording these methods. There are some programs out there. ARCH is the Mirena program. So hopefully with the ACOG statement this fall in October of 2012, we'll see more insurances picking up these long-acting methods, but that is absolutely a barrier for patients. They are quite a bit more expensive, however cost-effective over the 3 to 10 years that they're in place. Sorry.
Question and comment. Regarding the telemedicine aspect, do the patients have a telemedicine equipment? Can they use a laptop, a smartphone? And why not just a plain phone call?
Absolutely. Is this on?
No.
Can you guys hear me? Okay, so as far as the technology required from the patient's perspective, so anything that has a webcam, they are certainly eligible to do a telehealth visit in this circumstance. Now, granted, I had kind of alluded to the fact that we in our clinics, were set up with microphones for each visit, so I can actually have a real-time conversation with my patient. If they don't have that capability at home, we can certainly do some communicating just by typing. Now, certainly that can be extended to iPads, to cell phones that have a camera. Just like my wife said, FaceTime essentially is what we're doing. Now, the second part of the question, which was what again? Excuse me?
Why not just a phone call?
Oh, why not just a phone call? Well, that certainly fits under the category in general of e-visits. Now, what we think we gain through this is the fact that I can see my patient, that I can make that initial assessment to say my patient is well or my patient is not well. Using the acne follow-up, for example, if I were a dermatologist, I could physically see the lesions and have a overall assessment, not just taking the patient's word for it. Is she or he truly getting better with my treatment?
Now, with the Porter Clinic that uses the poverty type aspects, how many of these people have access to expensive...
All of them.
That's a great question. Once again, I mean, as long as they have internet access and webcam So granted, when we initiate this pilot program, we will certainly have to handpick our patients and see how things go from there.
Question for Wyatt. With the ultrasound and shoulder pathology, have you found that the orthopedists have bought into that? Because there's a lot, you mentioned about rotator cuff injuries, which are pretty well described with ultrasound, but not labral tears and some other pathology. So I find sometimes if ultrasound is done, oftentimes an MRI is ordered after that anyway. So I'm wondering if you can comment on that. And then my second quick question for Crit is, on acute visits, you mentioned UTIs. How do you get a urinalysis and a urine culture on an e-visit? And I would say the same thing about a strep test.
Well, I mean, I think that as the technology becomes more widely used, people have more confidence in it. I doubt that you could go in and refer someone and somebody would be taken to surgery based on just ultrasound results alone, although you can see those pictures. And in fact, to bill for it, you have to save those pictures in some sort of a medium, usually in your electronic medical record. And so they could be shown. It is probably just not being done widely here. The other thing is that oftentimes you end up ordering the MRI because of the ultrasound findings. And I think that would be decreased as it became more common.
So to answer your question, once again, this is a question that has come up a lot in this realm. To answer the question about urinalysis, I would state some research that was done, and it was actually published in an article in the American Family Physician back in October of 2011. They looked at two different fairly large-scale studies about urinary tract infections in particular, and patients that self-diagnosed or self-treated versus patients that were actually seen in office, and remarkably, they were equivalent. Those patients that had urinalysis done, those patients that were seen in their primary care physician's office versus those patients that called their physician and said, I've had these symptoms before, I've got dysuria. So in that particular instance, we have to ask ourselves as a whole, are we truly creating better outcomes by getting the urinalysis? As far as the strep test is concerned, once again, a question that needs to be answered. However, when we see patients in the Instacare and we can see the exudate, we can see the palatal petechiae, and they have the symptoms that certainly are consistent with that of a strep, we make the diagnosis. Now, this has been a question that we have certainly discussed and opens up an entirely different aspect, is the legality of this. Are we potentially putting ourselves out on the line to get in trouble if we don't have diagnostic objective evidence to say we're treating properly? Once again, that's something that has to be investigated as we go forward.
I'm afraid I didn't catch all the names, but some statements about opioids were made, which I find very surprising. Studies in the past have certainly shown that an opioid plus an NSAID is more effective than either drug alone. And studies in the past have found that medical prescription of opioids has only rarely led to abuse. And you are giving me information which seems to contradict past studies in my clinical experience.
So when I went to research this topic, I wanted to get the most up-to-date research articles. So the American Society of Interventional Pain Physicians, the one I based most of this off of, this came out in 2012, and this was based on 500 studies that they had analyzed and reviewed, creating evidence-based guidelines for responsible prescribing. So that's where these statistics are coming from. And I think reading their guidelines has probably done the best thing for me and my future patients in the way that I will prescribe these medications. All of this information sounds shocking, and I think it's because it is. I would love to get anybody's email that would like these articles to read over these. It's really a remarkable study.
and information.
If may I offer my congratulations to the residents and the residency program for these presentations over the years. As I have mentioned, I wish I had thought of it years ago. My question is specifically for Dr. Varney. In the prescribing venue of the family physicians and residents, was there any difference, or were you able to tell where this was prescribed, as, for instance, in the urgent care or insta-care versus office? Where you know your patients, it would seem to me there would be less abuse.
When the data was presented to me, it didn't delineate between regular office visits and insta-care.
That, to me, would be of useful information. My own impression is that those persons who see a patient acutely with no evidence of follow-up are more likely to prescribe the opioids than otherwise.
My question is for Ashley, formerly Dr. Wentworth. I didn't catch your new congratulations, by the way. Access. So, do you know anything about the Accountable Care Act and how that will affect access to birth control? And secondly, when we're talking about adolescents having a procedure done, say an IUD or an implant, what are the age limits? You know, do we need parental? Do we have to have parents' consent?
This is bad, and I'm going to have to apologize to Jesse, but I do not know the answers to either of those questions. I don't know how the Accountable Care Act is going to influence access. And then I know that I deep down do know the adolescent legality of birth control, and I'm pretty sure that it is okay to prescribe because it's a reproductive issue, but I'm saying that with a little bit of hesitation. If someone in the audience can help me, I'm almost positive you're okay to prescribe. There we go, thumbs up from the back row. So birth control is fine for adolescent patients without parental consent because it's a reproductive issue.
Even if it's a procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the Accountable Care Act, at least my understanding of it, is that these options will be available for just as cheap as anything.
Fingers crossed.
Dr. Adema, my question's for you with the e-visits. I actually have two questions, if that's okay. First of all, what about the value of the physical exam? You know, patients are very well informed, and they come in and they say, well, I have a classic this or a classic this, and it ends up being completely different than what they told you they're coming in for in the first place. So, like, you know, underlying malignant conditions that we would have missed had we not been there with them face-to-face, how do we address that versus a computer screen?
So first off, I'd like to say that in a lot of circumstances, this may end up just being a triage tool. That if we're seeing patients that have concerning symptoms, that have something that needs a much higher level acuity of care, then we may end up just sending them somewhere else. Or if we recognize a situation that needs to have a more hands-on diagnosis, certainly in that circumstance, we just need to invite them in for a regular office visit.
Thank you, and that leads into my second question. I work in an urgent care facility where it's subsidized healthcare. So the patient population that I see don't have insurance. Mm-hmm. So they come into the urgent care hoping to avoid the ED, and then we end up sending them anyway. So I can see a situation where a patient would set up this e-visit, be billed for the e-visit, we tell them to come in because we want to see them face-to-face because it's an urgent care, and then when they're there, we end up sending them to the ED anyway. They get billed for three different things, and the cost increases with each visit.
Right.
How is that mitigated?
So certainly a concern. Now, speaking specifically to our pilot program, and that's why I put up the slide, to the group that we're targeting are those that aren't necessarily requisite that we have a complete physical exam done. Now, unfortunately, there will always be these circumstances, I think, that will be unavoidable. But looking at this particular realm of medicine and as a whole, those of us that have worked urgent care, insta-care, or even ER for that matter, I think a lot of these visits could, quite frankly, take place via an online visit. And so when we're talking about overall costs to patients and the healthcare system as a whole, this is a valuable option because in general, I think most people could certainly be treated by a conversation. Whether it be UTI, whether it be a rash, whether it be a URI for that matter, in most circumstances, I venture to say, and granted I may be sticking my neck out there a little bit, but I think most of these can be diagnosed online. However, there will be those circumstances in which unfortunately leads to increased cost to a patient on an individual basis.
Dr. Varney, can I ask you a question? You know, when I started out as a new physician, I was also did not use opiates very often because I didn't think they were appropriate. But in the real world, you know, you hear all this information that they're so horrible, but what is the alternative in some patients? I mean, we have old people that can't take anti-inflammatories. They've tried repeated injections. So if they're going to throw this information out, are they going to give some backside that what can we do for these patients? I mean, I have patients that would be in a chair and basically be dead by now if they didn't have a little bit something to allow them to get up and move. And these are the older folks. I mean, these are not the 20-year-olds with back pain. These are the older folks that need something to keep them going. And I'm really feel bad because I feel like I'm a villain because I am prescribing these medicines, but I don't know what else to do for these patients. So you hear this information. What are they going to do about it? I mean, are they going to do more research that we can use something else for them? I don't know. I'm at a loss.
So we as physicians, we want to help people, and that's why we went into medicine. So it's hard for us to say no, and sometimes we always want to be able to give something and to relieve their pain and to heal them. And the reality is, it says sometimes we'll never take away all their pain, and they may live with a certain amount of pain in their life. First-line therapy for osteoarthritic pain is Tylenol. Studies have shown that we underutilize this, and some studies have even showed that the opioid analgesics that we use that have the combination of hydrocodone, oxycodone, and Tylenol, it's actually the Tylenol that's giving more benefit to reduction of pain versus the opioid.
Yeah.
I think in the long term, we have to weigh the risk and the benefits. Mm-hmm. The patients can ultimately choose that if they would like to, but we have to realize that long term, this is not benefiting our patient, and in fact, even harming our patients.
It's a little biased, too, because it's the interventional people that are giving this data. I mean, go to the primary care and the ground level when people, you know, like I said, in the old days, they would die a premature death because they sat in a chair and became, just died. Now, at least they're functioning. So, mm-hmm. I don't know. I just think there needs to be a lot more research for chronic, you know, elderly pain or non-back pain. Because interventional, you think of back pain.
Right.
But there's 100 other types of pain that need to be addressed.
I agree.
So, thank you.
So this is for Scott, so he doesn't feel left out of the group. And Ashley might be able to answer part of this as well. She noted in her discussion that, you know, maybe 50% of our adolescent pregnancies are unintended or even higher. Your discussion talked about the importance of getting these women of all ages who need earlier care, you know, educating them to come in for earlier care. How do you go about that? Do you have a proposed idea, or did you find anything that said, you know, this is how we could address that to these women who 50 or more might actually have unintended pregnancies? How do we get that information out to those women who might not even be planning on getting pregnant?
So part of that, Tyler, is that just the next step, we've got to find out why, get a better idea why some of these girls are coming in earlier for pregnancy versus why those are not. So we do have to one of the weaknesses is that they didn't want to respond directly to the survey. So we actually have to, a better way to get the information is probably to do those focus groups. Talk, get a group of these women together and get a better idea of and compare the difference between those who did come in early and those who didn't. And so that's one of the reasons. Another is education. There's other community interventions that we can do and propose. It'd be based on what we find. So,
question for Dr. Varney. You said 5% of the physicians who are prescribing opioids are giving 25% of all the drugs. Was there anything about the practice characteristics that were different? Number one. Number two, do you have anything that you would suggest to do with that? Educating the doctors or intervention of any kind?
So one of the things that this article talked about was that we as family medicine physicians we don't have enough education in pain management to adequately treat it to the benefit of the patient. That there are cases when long-term opioids are indicated, but we're not making that separation. The physicians, the four physicians that had the highest amount, the 25%, tend to be physicians that are known in the community for treating pain. Some of them do have higher levels of education with advanced training in pain management. I'm not sure about several of them, or a couple of them. So, and that may be because many family physicians within our community refuse to do opioids, and therefore somebody has to. And so these physicians may get a larger number of these patients.
So just to finish up, for Dr. Peterson, so you're not sitting there with nothing to say. Given that the Ogden Marathon is happening tomorrow, and some of you on stage there will be participating in the medical care, are you suggesting that our hyponatremic athletes that come in should be given hypertonic saline in that medical tent setting versus sent to the ER?
It depends on the level of their symptoms, Steve. So if they were seizing, yes. I would. I would recommend that they be given that small 100 milliliter bolus, as the literature suggests, but I really don't see that happening. It is a very rare occurrence. It's also not going to be hot enough for people to be overhydrating enough. Though, of course, this isn't as competitive a marathon, so there will be a number of slower athletes. And athletes who took longer than 5 hours to finish, women, and then those with no prior marathon experience are the highest at risk for hyponatremia. So we could consider it, and if someone seized, I would argue they should get it, but it won't happen.
Again, congratulations to the residents. Great presentations, and thank you.